My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and today I'm going to be interviewing Michael and Diana. They are listeners of Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices, and their story is different than some that we've heard. They've got a lot of international experience, and Michael was a bishop, so I was really excited to bring them on and talk to them about their life in Mormonism, especially since they've experienced Mormonism abroad, and to talk to them about their disaffection. So welcome, Michael and Diana.
Well, glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so let's go ahead and just jump right in. I do these interviews chronologically. So, who wants to start? Well, I guess maybe we should start with Michael and his childhood in Mormonism.
Okay. Right. My parents were both teachers. We lived in Vancouver, Washington, just across from Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And they were baptized in late 1957 or 1958. Mm-hmm. And so they brought, my sister and me into the church as well. I was just at 8 years then, I think.
And is your sister older or younger?
Younger.
Younger. Do you remember, how were you, how did your parents join the church? Did missionaries knock on your door? Was it a referral from a friend? How did that happen?
No, they were tracked out by one elder from Salt Lake City and one from Idaho Falls.
Okay. And do you remember that? Do you remember taking the discussions and the decision to join the church and your baptism and all of those things?
Not at all.
You don't? Okay. So you were probably young enough that most of your memories of being a kid are being of being a Mormon kid.
Right. Okay. In fact, that's a major identity with the church. Mm-hmm. And okay. Though I've never lived in Utah, I do kind of identify it as a culture.
Okay.
One of my cultures.
All right. What was it like being the only Mormon in your extended family, for your family?
I didn't notice any tension or any problems with it.
Well, both of your parents are only children.
Oh, okay.
So that cut down the possibilities.
Okay, I see. And then tell me about moving to California.
Soon after the baptism, my parents started to go through separation and then divorce proceedings. And then my mother went to Eugene, Oregon. Mm-hmm. Took my sister with her, and I stayed with my father. My father tried to keep the relationship going, and so we would commute to Eugene from Vancouver often. Mm-hmm. But finally, he got a job in Eugene, or just outside of Eugene, and we moved there to continue. He was still hopeful. But then there was no possibility of them getting back together. So he had someone in Vancouver that he was interested in, so then we started commuting back and forth from Eugene.
Back to Vancouver.
Back to Vancouver. And so, yeah, they finally married. She had four kids. Mm-hmm. And I was the oldest in the family still. So. Mm-hmm. Then we moved to Sacramento. He got a job teaching in high school, and we started a fairly active church life then.
Okay. Did your mother stay active in the church?
No, she didn't.
She didn't. Did you spend time with her in summers and things like that?
I did. We kept a fairly good relationship. We were able to do that.
So during those summers, did you attend church, or was it just kind of like you do Mormon stuff with Dad and non-Mormon stuff with Mom?
Basically. But my mother moved from Eugene down to Anaheim.
Oh, so it was easier to see.
Well, that was much easier to not go to church then.
Yeah.
I mean, with all the things to do at the beach and Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So, as a teenager, did you have faith struggles due to your mom not being terribly Mormon and your dad having an active life? Or did you always have a testimony and consider yourself Mormon and believe and all of that?
Well, that's something I've been wondering about for a long time. I considered it natural, I guess, because throughout most of my life, I had been part of the church, and it had been drummed into me that this is the right thing to do, so I accepted that.
Okay.
So I did not have a strong spiritual experience up until my high school years.
You know how they say fish don't perceive the water because they're in it? Was that how kind of Mormonism was for you? It was just part of your water?
Yes, I'd say that's right.
Okay.
But I must say that I had a fairly good time in the church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was interesting. Participated in all the events. I mean, the boys' events were great.
Mm-hmm.
We had a set of leaders for the boys.
Okay.
So it was always interesting, and church was interesting just because of the association with a lot of the leaders.
Right. Okay, so tell me about your spiritual confirmations that you received in high school.
I guess that would have to be around the Book of Mormon because it was emphasized so much and I read it so much. And I would not say that they were really spiritual confirmations. I think they were probably more social confirmations.
Mm-hmm.
That this is family, that not just my family, but the church was family.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we did. This is our history, and this is what we believe.
Right. But at the time, did you feel like they were your question, that you were receiving spiritual confirmation that these things were true?
I suppose I did.
Okay.
Yes. I would get up and bear testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I would feel the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say that it was more than just the approbation of the people in the congregation that gave me the confirmation.
Right. Okay.
So you always do what you're supposed to do.
Yes, I was
very strong.
I was a very obedient son.
Okay. All right. So, Diana, you did not have a religious upbringing, correct?
That's correct. I did not. Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think my parents may have attended a church regularly, but stopped well before I was old enough to remember.
Okay.
And only occasionally attended any church. Usually it was a special event, a concert, or I went with a friend's family. Until I was in middle school, and I think my mother didn't want to send me all the way across town to the Big Bad High School, so I went to a small private Catholic school for 2 years.
Okay.
And that was interesting.
And how was that for you as a non-believing kid to be in a religious setting?
It was okay because everyone knew I was not Catholic, and it was easy enough to read the lesson. You could figure out what the answer was supposed to be and give it.
Okay.
I can remember doing reports and looking into things, and I had straight A's in religion class, but I was always shaking my head inside thinking, I can't believe people really believe this.
Okay. So you never had any conflict with, well, this is what these people are saying about morality and how we should live our lives, and my mom's sending me here, so maybe this is valid, but this isn't what I see in my own home or around me in my secular environment. You didn't have any conflict with any of that. It was just all...
I don't think I gave it very much thought.
Mm-hmm.
I was going there, I think, because the high school was full of drugs and kids were having sex, and it was easy to see why my mom didn't want me there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I have a very close relationship with my mother, and my father was also in the Navy and gone a lot. So I think it was just the even physical proximity.
Okay.
Was probably more of a comfort to her also.
Okay. So after those 2 years, did you go to the Big Bad High School?
I guess I did. But I guess I suffer from the same obedience syndrome that you do. Is yes, I went to, we moved to a different state, went to a different high school. But I don't know, religion wasn't an issue. Mm-hmm. Wasn't just not part of our discussions in our family or our home.
Okay. All right. So let's go back to you, Michael. What did you do between your senior year of high school and going on a mission? Did you attend any college, or did you just wait it out until you went on your mission?
No, I went to a semester at the American River College in Sacramento. In fact, I had a course at that time or the next time from Dan Witherspoon's father.
Oh, okay.
He was teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it. I waited. I was called on the mission in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And went to France.
Went to France. Okay. Now tell me about going to the temple for the first time. How prepared were you? What did you think of it? All that kind of stuff.
Well, I have to say my first time in the temple was with my parents when they went to get sealed in Salt Lake.
Okay.
So I was very young. That was in 1959. And I remember getting into a fight.
Into a fight?
With one of the other boys down there waiting to get called up to.
Oh.
They kept us in the nursery or a holding pen waiting to be called up to participate in the ceremony with our parents.
Okay.
And an older boy picked on me, so we got into a fight.
And then you went through in 64?
Well, now in 64, that was, again, a different experience. We had just gotten to Sacramento with our new family. My parents wanted us all to be sealed together. So they asked me to go and visit my mother in Southern California to see if she would not mind having them adopt me. Because the church said, unless I was adopted by my stepmother, I could not be sealed.
Right.
So I thought that was a little traumatic, going to ask my mother if she would release me for adoption to somebody else.
Yeah, I could see how that would be quite a burden to place on a child. So how did your mother handle that?
Well, she cried.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, okay. And I'm not sure what difference it's made because we've been very close all that time and still are.
Right.
There was just a administrative formality.
Right. But it probably doesn't feel that way to a mother at that time, though.
Oh, I'm sure it doesn't.
Yeah. So in 64, just the same thing, you sat in the holding pen until you were called up?
Yes, basically.
Okay.
But 68 was my mission call, so that's when I went through the whole endowment.
And do you think having been to the temple a couple of times before that in your life, it was a little less scary or a little, there wasn't as much
mystery to it?
Yeah, mystery.
Perhaps. Yes, and I'd gone to the dedication of the Oakland Temple, which is where I finally had my endowments.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew the building.
The inside and all right.
But one thing I thought, and I saw this mentioned somewhere else on another blog, and this might seem really incongruous, but I was really active in the Boy Scouts, and part of that was the Order of the Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Order of the Arrow required a lot of initiation and a lot of this obscure
ceremonial stuff,
ceremony and symbology. And so I think that probably neared me a bit. So when I finally got to the temple, I was not so traumatized by all the signing and oath-taking.
Okay. But you went... Sorry, go ahead.
Because I'd already done it in another format.
Right. You went through before all the changes, obviously. None of it bothered you because of your experience with the other ceremonies, the death oaths and all of that?
Well, some of that bothered me. It was curious more than and frightening, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so tell me about your mission in France.
Well, I got there in 68, obviously, and there were some problems there. The mission had just suffered the death of the mission president's wife. She was killed in an automobile accident.
Oh.
So the whole mission was recovering from that. In addition, the mission had just gone through the 1968 riots, mm-hmm. which was very, very dramatic in France.
Mm-hmm.
And they were thinking of closing the mission for a while.
Oh, okay. So your experience with France at the very beginning was that it was a tumultuous place?
Yeah, there's some tension.
Didn't you get kidnapped?
Yeah, I did get kidnapped.
You got kidnapped?
By some farmers.
What for?
Well, it was part of the demonstration. It was a student and a labor series of riots throughout the country.
Uh-huh.
And I was just in the wrong place, and they said, "You look like an American, come with us."
Oh, dear.
So they took me to a farmhouse and kept me there for a while and then released me after they talked to the mission president, realizing that I would not offer any political
capital.
You weren't worth much, huh?
And they treated me very well. It was very nice. I got to go out and help them with the pigs.
Good cheese.
And the cheese. So,
well, that's an unusual aspect to a mission, I think.
And that lasted about 3 days.
Okay.
But another important factor was when I reported to the mission home, I stayed overnight with the missionary that baptized my parents.
Oh.
Because you're not set apart, at that time, you weren't set apart until you actually went into the mission home.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me something driving me to the mission home the next morning. He said, "Yes, I had a fiance. And she went to the French mission." Just at the same time, he went to the Northwest mission.
Uh-huh.
And then he told me that she was involved with the apostate episode with William Tucker and the Church of the Firstborn of the Fullness of Times or something like that, where 9 French missionaries were excommunicated. His fiance was one of them.
Oh, this is something I've never heard of before.
Well, yeah, and they went to Mexico to live with the LeBaron group.
Oh.
One of their primary pillars of faith was maintaining polygamy.
Hmm.
So this William Tucker had a few wives, and I think one of his wives was this elder's fiancé, former fiancé. Anyway, while I was there, I was curious to find out what happened and how it happened. It was only 10 years before I had arrived, but I was quickly told to desist.
Don't ask.
That's interesting. And is that because they didn't want to potentially send more people down that path, or it was just a sore spot and so people didn't talk about it?
They wanted to forget it.
Okay.
The members didn't need to remember anything.
So did you ever find out more about it? Did you look into it more when you came home or anything?
Oh, I did, yes. I think I know who it is, whose fiance was, and I know some of the ways that they managed to get a group of people together.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But this is a very charismatic elder who became assistant to the president, and just when he found like-minded people, he put them in districts where they could get together and discuss their religious philosophy.
So it wasn't somebody from the outside that had tricked these missionaries away. It was all internal.
They were all missionaries, elders and sisters.
Wow. Well,
They were getting literature from the States, from the LeBaron group.
Oh.
And some of their friends, but no, this is all French missionaries.
Huh. I have never heard of this before. I think I need to look into it.
Scooby Brown came over. Excommunicated. Well, they all went to London for the London Temple dedication. the whole mission went.
Uh-huh.
And while they were there, Hubie Brown, I think, excommunicated the nine of them.
Do you think going to the temple dedication was an excuse to get them there for the excommunication?
That was planned anyway.
Oh.
And I'm not sure that they...
Okay.
Could have done it anywhere else, but it was convenient, yes.
But I think overall you loved your mission and should talk about
it. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
In spite of all this.
Actually, these things were very interesting because I love studying about the riots.
Mm-hmm.
And thought my kidnapping was interesting, and the problems in 58 with the apostasy, that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. So,
yes, go ahead.
What was the philosophy of your mission, or your mission philosophy?
What was mine, I guess. I said, hey, I'm in France. Every morning I get up. What am I going to do today to enjoy it? So I was looking for opportunities to enjoy the mission. I did the work. In mm-hmm. fact, I think my missionary companionships were fairly busy.
Mm-hmm.
The success in baptisms was not reflective of the work we did.
I am sure that's probably the case in most European missions.
Right.
Okay. So you enjoyed the work, and probably the environment you were in was rather interesting.
Yeah, I could go get a baguette and some cheese and sausage. Have a
right.
great lunch.
Yeah, exactly.
Just no wine. That's all I guess. You couldn't drink wine.
Tell me about the newspaper appearance and how that came about.
Oh, well, one of our teaching mechanisms or systems was boards we placed up in the squares or the place in the center of the city. And so we'd have art or photo displays and with captions underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the themes that we had was the apostasy. And so we go through all the steps of the apostasy and how it led to Joseph Smith's experience in the Grove and his revelations and the establishment of the church. And so a reporter came down from the local newspaper to interview us and just ask us what was going on, what we were doing. So the next day, I looked in the newspaper and had a photo of a couple of us with these boards. And the title was Apostasy in the Streets with the Mormons. And I looked at that and I said, that's got two meanings there.
Yes.
But okay, good job by the reporter.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my...
Did you cut it out? Do you still have it?
I still have it.
You do?
I do.
Okay. So, in your original email that you sent me, you said that you followed the advice of bearing your testimony forcefully until you receive a confirmation of it.
Right.
And can you explain how that worked for you?
Well, we're always told, you know, bear it forcefully, do it as sincerely as you can, and the testimony will follow, and more sincerity will follow after that. Basically.
And did that work for you? Did you feel that that was a valid way of upholding your testimony?
I didn't get a real strong spiritual recognition of that. I did have reinforcement from, I guess, my own words.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Self-delusion, is that? But again, I thought this was natural. I thought, well, I'm doing what's right. This is the right thing to do, so these must be correct thoughts.
I'm looking at the notes that you gave me, and I'm wondering about the branch president.
Oh, this is in Tarbes, uh-huh. Southern France. It's right on the Spanish border in the Pyrenees.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very old branch president. Very old.
Doesn't seem so old now, does
no,
it?
Probably my age now. But he was a little lame. And then one day we were talking, and he said, oh, yeah, I used to be Catholic. And Tarbes is very close to Lourdes. And Lourdes is a shrine, a pilgrimage spot for the Catholic Church.
Is it the place where people go when they're ill because they want to be bathed in the water and stuff like that?
That's right. That's where Saint Bernadette supposedly saw the Virgin Mary.
Okay.
And so the whole town is this industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it is impressive. I mean, some of the ceremonies they have, because we would visit and go through some of the sites there. But he told me that he had been completely lame. He was confined to a wheelchair. And his friends took him to Lourdes.
Okay.
Yeah, for a long time. He could not walk. And they bathed him over the course of a week. And at the end of the week, he could get up and walk. And he had been walking ever since, even though it was with a limp. And so I asked him why he joined the Mormon Church. That experience that cured his legs. And he says, well, I think it was probably the God. The same thing I felt when the missionaries spoke to me. I said, this God can heal my legs. He can also take me to the right church. So he did. He converted.
Hmm.
I found a lot of that type of thinking.
Well, when we were speaking the other night, that was an aspect that we noticed in other countries where people would kind of pick and choose. They could accept Mormonism while still maintaining a lot of their own culture and heritage and mix them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the church really appreciates that.
Right.
They don't really officially allow that latitude.
Right, officially. But that doesn't stop the membership from doing it. So this guy was able to reconcile this miracle that had occurred for him, and yet the Catholic Church isn't true. I should be joining the Mormon Church. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So what were your interactions with Boyd K. Packer?
Well, he came over to interview us during a month. And I was assigned as his driver for a week or so of that. And it was just interesting. He's all, as an actor or as an apostle, he was always on. Even sitting in the back seat, he would speak to anybody else in the car. Same way he would speak from the pulpit.
He didn't really have a casual interaction with people.
I never saw that.
Interesting. Did he seem friendly and engaging?
He seemed neutral. He did not seem friendly to me.
Huh.
He did not seem hostile or antagonistic.
Did he talk to you at all?
Yes, he did. But it felt like a continuous interview, though.
Understood. So it was more like you were in a formal setting with him rather than just riding in a car.
Right.
Okay. Okay, so when you got home from your mission, you went into the Navy, correct?
Right. I applied for admission to the Naval Academy, and I was accepted for the next summer.
Mm-hmm. And that was something you had always wanted to do?
I'd wanted to do that, yes.
Okay. Were there any conflicts between what you were experiencing in the Navy and what your identity was as a Mormon or the Mormon Church?
Well, I think I mentioned there something about a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very long physical and other academic application procedure. Part of that physical was interviewed by a psychiatrist. Everybody had it. And at the end of it, he looked at me and said, I don't think I can recommend you for the Naval Academy because you spent 2 years on a mission. We can't have a naval officer go into his cabin and just read the Bible all the time. And it says here, you never had sex. And so I just don't think that's healthy, is what he told me.
So he thought you were a bit of an extremist.
Yes.
Okay.
I kind of laughed and I said, well, I don't think you have to worry.
But he let you in, obviously.
I don't know if he did or they just ignored what he said.
Oh, okay.
I didn't see the comments.
Okay. Did you were obviously attending church in Annapolis, I would guess. And what was the post-mission church experience like for you? Did you enjoy your ward?
We did, but again, it was a mixture of what I was doing at the academy or at school than at church. I was never really wholly engaged in the ward activities. We were always apart. We're the midshipmen, so they're going to treat us in a different way. And a lot of times it was very nice and special. They assigned us sponsors in the ward to help us, you know, with things outside the academy. Mm-hmm. The first 2 years at the academy were pretty rough then because you had very limited privileges and access to the outside. It was fairly regimented.
Mm-hmm.
So the church connection was important. We had some outside contact. We got to visit on Sundays.
So the church was still a positive force for you.
It was.
Okay. Yeah. Now, you told me that there were some racial tensions in the Navy, and so you had to go to seminars?
Right. This was the wind down from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of racial tension throughout the Navy, throughout all the armed forces. We had riots on aircraft carriers.
Really?
Yes.
Because of racial tensions.
Right. It was nice. So the Navy said all the units, and they called it a stand down, would stand down and have training or these seminars on racial relations.
Okay. And
during the conversation, just in my little small company, a discussion came up about what racism is. And part of that was we started talking about institutional racism.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top of the list was the Mormon Church.
And that was in one of the seminars or just in the course of conversations with people?
No, that was an official seminar documentation.
Really?
And, you know, it kind of struck me. I had never really thought of it. You know, I have to say, you know, I was gliding through my life in something that I considered natural and everybody should enjoy as well as I.
Uh-huh.
And this kind of struck me pretty hard. And again, I said, oh, no, this, you know, we're not racist, are we? I said, well, yeah, maybe we are. Because it never come up that way. And then I thought of all the things I'd read during the 60s and up to that date, I think it was 1974. You know, I said, yeah, even though we don't claim it as doctrine or policy today, it was pretty strongly impressed upon us that this is the way race figures into the church.
So you had been formally taught that people who were not white had been less valiant in the pre-existence and all of that kind of stuff?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. And it was something that just, due to the culture that you were raised in, you just kind of went along with it? You never thought about it?
Well, again, I don't know if this is a shelf item or not. I just mm-hmm. thought it was something that would be handled later, not by me, but by the priesthood.
Okay. You just thought that this is something that I think people do this a lot with stuff in the church that either bothers them or they don't understand. They say, well, this will be something that I understand in the future, or this will be something that is handled in the future. And so or it's something that isn't my responsibility and that will be taken care of by the church's system, so I don't have to worry about it.
That's right. And looking at it now, I mm-hmm. wish I had been completely embarrassed by it. I am now.
Right. Understood.
But at that moment, I wish I would have stood up and said, this isn't right.
Right.
But I think you're right, Heather. That's very much what happens with so many issues. And part of that is because life is still happening so fast and you have so many other pressures and expectations put on you by the church that, you know, you have to let go of those things you don't have control over and just get to the very long to-do list that you mm-hmm. can do something about.
Right. So in that seminar, did you say anything? Did you just keep your head down?
I don't recall completely, but I am sure my head was down.
Okay. So you didn't take that as and I wouldn't blame you at all, but you didn't take that as an opportunity like, well, God is, I'm testing me, I need to stand up and defend the church or anything like that?
I did not.
I think that's completely understandable.
It was kind of a shock. I said, ooh, they are not going to understand this.
Right. So you were stationed in Japan, I guess?
Right.
Okay. And that's where you met Diana?
Right. I went to a ship in Japan. Mm-hmm. And because of her family involvement in the Navy, they had moved to Japan as well. And I met her in a restaurant one night.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell them?
The abbreviated version. We saw each other in the restaurant one night. We did not speak to each other. I was actually working at the restaurant for two nights only, three nights only, filling in for a friend who was sick. And I think it was my job to deliver the drinks to tables. Very crowded place, very...
It was on the naval base.
Naval base, there were just thousands, tens of thousands of young sailors. And it was my job to walk between the tables and to deliver drinks. And I had been pinched and prodded and asked out by disorderly drunkards a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
But on the third night, Michael came in and we didn't speak, but... it was just kind of that sparks across the room, don't you think? And one of the other staff that I was working with, I mentioned something. He was going to deliver drinks to that table, which I'm sure was orange juice. Mm. And I said, oh, let me take it. I asked him, he thought he knew you because they were on the same ship. So he said, yeah, I think I know him. I think he has a wife and a couple kids. And I said, okay, well, that's that. So I went on working and didn't think much of it. And a week later, got a telephone call at the house. I answer it. And someone on the other line, hello, I'm Mike Watson. Would you like to go out? And I said, yes. Which was very unusual because I wasn't interested in seeing anyone. And people that had asked me out the last week at the restaurant, I didn't want to go out with.
Mm-hmm.
But I somehow connected this name with the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I hung up, realized I had no idea who this was. Only hoping that the voice I heard on the phone matched the face I saw at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So... we called back later to get more instructions to our house. And in Japan, it's hard to explain the tiny, tiny little alleyways and roads.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell them how to get to our house. There's no street signs or street names or numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said, park here at the palace by the beach and walk uphill and I'll see you. And my idea was... that I would look out from behind the shrubs at this little Shinto temple that was behind our house. And if it was who I wanted to go out with, I would step up and say hello. And if it wasn't, I would just go back down my little alleyway and never be found.
Clever.
But it all worked out, and we went out.
So were you there because of your father's naval...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I was.
Okay. So you guys dated and things went well?
Things went very well. We went out, I think we kind of had a 3-in-1 the first date. We left in the morning, took the train to Yokohama, went to a professional baseball game.
Mm-hmm.
Which was nice because on the train it was so crowded that you're forced to hold hands so you don't get lost in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So that took care of that awkward moment. Then we went out to dinner and then we went dancing at three different locations. So it was really a marathon date. And by the end of that, that was kind of it.
It was kind of one of those compressed dating.
Yeah. It was like life will never be the same.
When did
we dated when we could, but we met when? What month? April?
April.
he was on a ship that was gone 80% of the time. And then I went back to the States when my family moved in August.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And we were married in December.
We were married in December. Yeah.
Okay. So when in that time frame did the church come up?
It did not.
Says, I'm leaving the room.
I think that bearing your testimony ended at the mission, end of mission, because Michael never said anything about the church. And it was actually my mother, after some time, who said, you know, I think he's Mormon.
You had no idea he was even Mormon?
No, volunteered nothing.
Interesting.
Volunteered. And, I mean, after we had figured it out, I knew that you went to church occasionally, which was quite a ways from us, and would come later in the afternoon, and we'd go out or just stay at our house. But never, never, never discussed anything about it. No pressure, no questions, no come to church.
I think I was reluctant, because I was very serious. I was reluctant to, and I know maybe this is some of this innate embarrassment I felt about some of the things we were teaching, which was probably justified at that time. I just didn't want her to look at this church and think it was crazy and
reject you because of it.
Associate me with that craziness.
Yeah.
So I think my involvement and questions came after I had moved back to Texas, because I had between August 1st and the end of December just to wait.
Did you guys get engaged in August or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you got engaged and then you went back home to the United States and you had this fiance in the military type relationship.
Right.
Until you were married.
And this was back in the days of writing letters by hand and hoping that the post came.
Mm-hmm. Checking all the time.
And I had just left on a deployment to the Indian Ocean.
Yes, and Australia, which was the worst mail. Mm-hmm. So we wrote back and forth a lot, and it was great. But I had all this time, so I thought, well, he's the greatest thing ever. Maybe that's because he's Mormon. I better find out more about this. And if I'm going to be part of his life, I need to know about this. So I actually called and asked the missionaries to come to our house. You can imagine how excited they were.
Yeah.
Stunned.
Mm-hmm.
So they came over and they gave lessons, and it was always just me. I think my mother or the rest of the family sometimes listened in the wings but never participated. And I went through so many sets of missionaries because I would just nod my head, okay, I want to know about all this, but I would not be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And
why? What was your resistance to being baptized at that point?
Probably that if I was going to be baptized, Michael should be the one to do it.
Oh, okay. So were you starting to accept the church at that point? Was the church making sense and you were thinking you wanted to convert?
I don't think I thought about it that deeply. Mm-hmm. I was just crazy in love.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just more curious and wanted to know, because I guess I knew this would be part of our life.
Okay.
And then first very, very negative experience was when we were actually planning a wedding. We were just going to get married at our home, but I needed someone to officiate, so I thought. So I went and talked to one of the local bishops and asked him if he'd be willing to marry us. I mean, why not? I mean, it didn't matter to me who it was. I just wanted to be married.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anyone else or have any other connections. So I left that interview crying, thinking, how awful it was, that he just made me feel so terrible that this was not going to be a good marriage. I was not worthy to be married in the chapel. They just did not do those kind of things. But
so
our house.
You were a non-believing and or you were a non-Mormon who was investigating the church, marrying a Mormon, and so you went to visit with your bishop, essentially.
Right.
To see if he would do the ceremony, and he
made me cry.
Made you feel like crap. What kinds of things did he say to you?
Well, I guess it was the first, a lot of it probably didn't sink in and make sense, but I'm sure it was, this isn't a, you know, we only approve of temple marriages. And I don't even remember all the details, just that I was completely traumatized and felt really bad.
Okay, so it might have been that the bishop was operating under that whole, you're setting up your marriage for failure if you don't wait to get married until you've joined the church and can go through the temple and do it right.
Right. It was very much, this is not how things are done.
Okay. But he probably lacked the sensitivity to understand how that would come across to you as a non-believer.
Probably. I mean, he was a very nice, soft-spoken man. I mean, he wasn't yelling or anything. And in the end, probably more from a lack of any other ideas, he did actually marry us.
Okay.
But in your living room.
Yeah, in our living room.
Because you just couldn't do it at the church.
Right. And now, you know, of course, when I look back, I just think, why in the world did I put myself through this? Why didn't we just go to City Hall and sign the paper and come home to a party?
Okay. Despite this interview with the bishop, was the wedding good?
The wedding was fine. It was very low-key. We probably had 10 people in attendance. Michael's mother traveled to come with one of his nephews.
Mm-hmm.
And the only tough part for me was the person who is never, ever late in his life was about 20 minutes late, which was a very long time. And I was very concerned because I knew that he had been engaged twice before.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he skipped over that. He had been, and one of them ended, was called off 2 weeks before the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So I was petrified that, oh no, he's not going to show up.
Was his mother there waiting for him to show up too?
No, I think that's why they were a little late, is he was picking her up and
okay.
They were coming together. But it was very scary. But after he rang the doorbell, all was well.
Good. So you guys moved back to Japan?
Yes.
Well, yeah, that, to my little apartment that I had for a few years.
Okay. And were you still on an 80% deployment?
Yes.
Close to it. Because as soon as we got back to Tokyo or to Yokosuka, I had to leave.
Days. Yeah.
And so you were alone most of the time in Japan.
Right. But I was somewhat familiar because we were going back to the same location that I had lived when my family was there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you must have introduced me to
the best three women in my ward.
Yeah, the people that lived closest to us. And they were great.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really nice people. And during this period, I was probably thinking, I don't know about all this doctrine. I don't know if I want to hurt my head trying to make sense of it. But these are really nice people. And they're trying really hard to live a good life, to be good people. And that probably had more to do with my impression of Mormonism than anything else.
Okay. How did you decide to be baptized?
Well, I started attending, and then I had this group of friends who were all lifelong, many generation Mormons. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of doing everything I was supposed to be doing anyway. And that was just,
so when
that
I got
was
back,
like the next box to check off on your to-do list of things that you are supposed to be doing.
Okay.
So I got back and we went up to a Japanese ward building in Tokyo. And had a lot of friends there.
Mm-hmm.
And back too.
Yeah. I think one of the other things about the church out of the country in a more remote location is that you tend to be very close, very fast, because you're so far away from family and culture. There's a much greater bond and closeness and support that you get from one another, much more so than we've ever experienced within the U.S.
Right. Okay, so you never, I mean, did you do Moroni's Challenge? Did you join the church on the basis of any faith at all? Or was it just that it was the social connection and you liked the culture and the attitude and the way your friends live their lives, and so you wanted to do that too?
Probably both. I do remember a night where I was, yeah, doing the scripture. If you just read this and pray about it, you'll do it. And it has to be really dense and slow, because I did this a number of times and I really prayed, should I be doing this? Is it the right thing? And I got such a bad feeling. Mm-hmm. It was so dark and awful. And I would go and turn on all the lights and then I'd try again. And it was kind of the usual thing of, you know, if you're not getting the answer you're supposed to, something's wrong with you, so you just better try again till you get the right answer.
Okay.
And by then, you know what that's supposed to be.
Right.
So eventually, I guess I talked myself into it.
Did you have any familiarity with the Joseph Smith story at that point?
I did, just on the missionary level.
Okay. So you didn't equate the darkness that you were feeling with, like, the adversary trying to stop you?
I think maybe I did afterward,
mm-hmm.
because it made a nice testimony story.
Mm-hmm. But at the time, it wasn't.
But at the time, it was just, it was awful.
Okay.
And it was, you know, like, if you were rolling dice, why would you be happy with the one good roll when you just had 10 bad ones?
Okay.
That's kind of how it was.
Mm-hmm. So you guys were in Tokyo when the Tokyo Temple was built.
Yes. Right.
How soon after your baptism did that occur?
Probably within a year.
Okay.
Yes.
So was that an important event in your early years as a member?
It was. I left a nursing child to go travel for the day and do that, which was traumatic in and of itself.
Right.
And it was also the first time, I think, that I really experienced the celebrity culture of Mormonism. And it was nice. I remember thinking, this is exciting. I'm part of history. But I didn't understand why people were treating this nice old man in such a fanatic way, why they really wanted to be in the front row, why it was so important to touch him or hold his, shake his hand.
Spencer Kimball.
Yeah. I mean, I was fine from a distance, but I didn't quite understand, I don't know, the level of putting so much faith and emphasis on one person.
Okay. So you said you had a nursing baby. How soon after your marriage did you get baptized? Did you say that already and I missed it?
Oh, very soon.
Yeah. It must have been just a couple months.
Okay. So
it was probably the first or second time the ship came back. Yeah. And okay. Then, yeah, our first son was born 18 months after we were married.
Okay, okay. So, you're a new member in Japan. Did you notice any changes from being an outsider with these Mormon friends and actually being a member with? Did you notice differences? What was it like to be a new member?
Well, my first reaction to your question is I was still an outsider.
Oh, you were.
I always felt like an outsider. It was, I don't know, converts are kind of a step down from I was born in the covenant. I've always been, I have ancestors, pioneers.
Hmm.
So, and there was, I also noticed a very big difference between I'm a Utah Mormon and I'm from somewhere else Mormon. So I kind of felt I was the third tier down.
Really? Huh.
Yeah. I mean, not in a rude way. I mean, no one was nasty about it. I mean, this was really a wonderful support group and close friends. But I always felt I will never really be one of them.
Because you just hadn't been saturated with it your entire life.
I think so, because yeah. I had just a wider view of the world and possibilities, and it was easier for me to accept different cultures and different ideas because I knew there were a lot of ways to do things. There wasn't just one right answer.
Okay.
So that was always an issue for me.
Okay. I experienced a little bit of that from the opposite end. In my family ward as a teenager, there was a lady who was a convert, and if she said anything that was just a little different, or if she had an idea about some doctrine that didn't jive with, you know, the way we were experiencing, it was always, well, she's a convert, so...
Yeah. Right. So in a way, it gives you a little bit of latitude because you don't know any better.
Right.
But, you know, a little condescension goes,
right.
Condescension goes a long way.
Okay. So.
But you also had a really big shock just about that same time.
Yes.
And what was that?
It was when they read.
And I feel completely irresponsible.
When they read the statement from the pulpit one Sunday about blacks could now have the priesthood.
Oh,
and
you didn't know.
My jaw dropped, and I think I even had to go out because I was hyperventilating. And I was so shocked because I didn't know that they had ever been denied it. And I was horrified that I had aligned myself with such a racist organization.
That would be a big shock. How did you come to terms with that or reconcile that and not just leave right then?
I don't know. I ask myself this all the time. It is one of many, many points that came up where I wonder, why wasn't that the moment?
Mm-hmm.
But it probably had to do with, you know, I don't understand. Like we spoke earlier, I don't understand it. Oh, well, they're progressing. I mean, if you read the Bible or the Book of Mormon, some of those practices have been changed. We progress and evolve. Things get better slowly. So, you know, I have something immediate to do, something more practical that needs my attention today. So I probably just was intellectually lazy and didn't
pursue it further.
Try not to think about it.
Yeah. So did you watch the reactions of the people around you in the subsequent days and weeks?
Well, everyone seemed to think this was just really great. Pat themselves on the back and aren't we good? And I just thought it was horrifying.
So you just kind of sat back and got, you know, agog at the people around you kind of?
Right. And even though I had very good friends in the church at this time, my closest friends never were.
Mm-hmm.
They were always completely separate. I really kind of compartmentalized, you know, my life. There was the church social life, which was obligatory. Mm-hmm. And then there was the people and the places that I really enjoyed, and they were always completely separate.
Okay.
But we were married in the Tokyo Temple.
That was going to be my next question, was going through the temple.
Right. On our second anniversary.
Yeah. So she's going to ask you how you felt.
Yeah. Did you have this experience with the blacks can now have the priesthood before or after going through the temple?
Before.
So you went to the temple after that, and what was your reaction to the temple?
I don't know. Again, it was probably my primary focus was I will have our son sealed to us.
Okay.
And, you know, then we were safe. That was right. We had another box checked. The endowment and all itself, I did have friends from the ward going through with me that kind of held my hand along the way, which was nice and very helpful. In the ceremony itself, I just thought, this is so silly. And a letdown from all the great things it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be new and wonderful, and you'll learn so much, and your life will change. And it didn't.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much that you thought the promising to disembowel yourself was creepy. It was just that nothing changed.
Well, that was seriously weird. That's another one that got tucked away with many other things is, really? Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to disembowel myself? I don't think so. And the usual thing about you will obey your husband.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in my case, that's not difficult because my husband doesn't really demand a lot of obedience. But it really made me think about a lot of the other relationships that I saw around me.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of explained what I thought were some fairly unhealthy relationships.
Right. Growing up, I had a friend who couldn't come over to my house or go do anything unless she called her father at work to ask permission because her mother didn't have the authority to give her that permission.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see looking around at other relationships and thinking that there were problems there.
Right. I mean, a lot of times I felt I needed to just not speak up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't want people to feel bad when they were voicing their frustrations or their situation. And I didn't want to pipe up and say, yep, I'm happy, all good.
Yeah, yeah. Understood.
But yeah, I mean, the whole you'll be obedient, I think, caused some unhealthy relationships.
Mm-hmm. So, but the sealing part was probably nice.
It was. In fact, it was the only nice thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where the tears came, is when they brought our son in.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
And he hadn't been in any fights that I
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, it was very weird.
Right. So you guys were a young, married Mormon couple, having kids, having ward callings, having just a normal Mormon life?
Well, yeah, but
mostly. I don't know, because I never felt that I was a normal Mormon.
Okay.
I always felt I was keeping things to myself, biting my tongue, or very carefully voicing opinions in class, mm-hmm, about expanding, you know, not being so rigid.
Now, did you see those things as I'm okay with God, these people are just a little too uptight? Or did you see yourself as being outside of Mormon doctrine even when you had these things you were biting your tongue about?
It was usually about the we're exceptional, we're better than everyone.
Okay.
And I really disliked that. I didn't want to be seen as superior to anyone. Mm-hmm. And I disliked that message.
Okay. Okay. So did you guys have any more bumps along the way until Michael became a bishop? Or did you were you kind of just coasting along at that time?
I guess I have to offer an excuse because, you know, this is a good summary of the things we should have taken more note of along the way, because I hear some of the stories that that you interview and yours as well, where there's some strong, strong feelings. And
people act on them much sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but there's a lot of disappointment as well. I felt we moved so often. I think we've been in 14 or 15 different wards. That we relied more on the people that we met. Kind of reversed the little adage, the church is perfect, but the people aren't. As in, the people are more perfect.
People were much better than the organization.
The church, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think our moving had a lot to do with it. Had we stayed in any one place very long, I think we would have left much sooner.
Well, yeah, but everybody has a list of things that are going on in their life. And if you guys are moving all the time and you've got kids and there's all these changes you're constantly dealing with, Mormonism kind of never gets to the top of the priority list.
Right. And it does make an instant community.
Yeah.
When you know, moving. You're a nice young family. You've got all these cute little kids in tow and you show up. They're delighted to see you.
Yep.
And
kids have playmates, you have friends.
And we were both always very active. We did everything we were asked. So, you know, we were a good, dependable family. Mm-hmm. And by the time we had kind of had it or seen too much or knew too much, it was time to move. Sometimes that was 3 years. Often it was 18 months.
Right, because you were a career Navy guy, right, Michael?
Right.
Okay.
So we didn't have to resign, we just moved.
So before we get to your being a bishop, in your notes you said you had another interaction with Packer, and I don't know that you mean that you actually met him or anything, but because you have September 6 written down here. So I'm wondering, you guys were in California at the time, and was that a hurdle or a bump in your Mormon path, this September 6th and Boyd K. Packer's involvement and all that?
Yes, this is 1993.
Right.
All of 1993. Boyd Packer came to our state conference.
Oh, so you did meet him kind of again.
Yes, and made a very stern presentation on the subject. He didn't mention the people involved in the
excommunication.
Right. But he spoke very strongly against, and he said, intellectualism, feminism, deviation from the standards of church morality, including homosexual behavior. He was fairly explicit.
And do you know why he came? Why was he just scheduled to come to your your conference, or was there a reason he was there?
I don't know if there was a special reason. We took it as it was his assignment to visit the Monterey State or whatever the state. That might have been Salinas State, I'm not sure. But so we took it as a normal assignment. I don't know if there was anything he needed to deliver in that place or not, any special message.
Okay.
That some of the people needed to receive. I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, I thought, significant. All these other things I've been thinking about started really coming together. This is when I started with dialogue.
Maybe everything isn't quite
deviation.
So black and white.
Orthodoxy.
you were there when he gave the talk?
Yes.
And do you remember your reaction at the time? Were you horrified by what he was saying? And
I think I would just remember the sensation of being cold.
Okay.
I guess that's numb.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But it, for whatever reason, well, for obvious reasons, probably sparked a need for you to start looking at things a little bit more, and that's why you started with the dialogue and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and I had just been called as high priest group leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt a real pull. I should be supportive. I should be able to stand behind some of the things that are being said by our general authorities and not question them as I was at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you were in Belgium when you were called to be a bishop. And in your initial letter to me, you said that that had a huge impact on your belief. Can you explain what it was like to be a bishop and how that affected your belief?
It was a little odd situation. We belonged to the Brussels International Ward, which is an English-speaking ward.
Uh-huh.
And then I was called to be on the state presidency, which is French-speaking,
mm-hmm.
for the entire section of the French-speaking section of Brussels or Belgium.
Are you multilingual?
Yes.
Okay.
So then, from there, the state president called me to be a bishop of another ward.
Yeah.
Not the one I was a member of.
Okay.
And not the member, and not the same one I would continue to attend.
Right. I had to attend it by myself.
What was objectionable about the ward?
Oh, nothing.
Yeah.
No, well, you mean why couldn't they find another bishop?
Or why wasn't it one that you would continue to attend?
I didn't attend the French speaking because I don't speak
French. Oh, okay. It was just a language barrier.
It was just language.
Okay, so, I understand.
So he called me be the bishop of this French speaking ward.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a lot of these things, the members would ask me some of the basic questions that I thought they don't need to be asking their bishop about this. This is something they should take care of themselves. And I don't need to know the exact percentage point of tithing you need to pay. Just tell me that you're paying tithing and I'll accept it. Or
so they were looking for fast and hard rules, and you felt that they should be determining their obedience themselves?
Well, and a lot of personal
questions like, can I take off my garments while we have...
Oh, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
So don't ask me. I said, you do what you feel like. If it makes you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had somebody come to me with a problem. And I counseled him on it and just sent him away. And then I got a call from the state president and said, we need to take him to a court. I said, I don't think we do.
So how did the state president know about this? Did he...
I don't know.
Okay. But he wanted to excommunicate the guy?
He wanted to excommunicate him. And I said, this isn't deserving. And he went ahead with the procedure and ended up disfellowshipping him. But I don't think I earned any points with the state president.
And it obviously left a sour taste in your mouth.
Yes, because I was inclined to be a little more lenient in whatever standing I had as a so-called judge in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But you were usually very considerate and compassionate of families and relationships, and thought that maintaining a family relationship or a marriage was more important than some of the smaller details, or
yes,
even a little bit bigger details.
Okay. So did all of this stuff start to impact your faith?
Yes, because I had to get up weekly and then tell them how I thought Joseph Smith was a prophet, and therefore Gordon B. Hinckley was a prophet. Actually, it was not Gordon B. Hinckley. It was
Benson.
And then I started thinking, I can't say these things with any sincerity anymore.
So you had started to lose faith that they were actually prophets?
Yes.
And was that due to what you were seeing as a bishop, or was that because you were starting to question the authenticity of the whole Mormon story.
I was questioning authenticity. Finally, I was able to sit down and really evaluate it.
Okay.
And again, you know, there's a little guilt here. I should have done this years ago. But yes, I could say later is better than never.
So was that because of things you were learning through dialogue or?
Oh, that was, yes, some of it. And then some things I would just be reading through the normal church manuals.
Okay. But you stayed in the church after that for a while, didn't you?
Yes, I was released and we went back to South Carolina.
Okay. You probably, I'm assuming, the moving and the changing in your life probably took more precedence than continuing to deal with the Mormon issues. And since you weren't a bishop, maybe they kind of weren't as pressing as they were when you were a bishop?
No, it became a little more serious because now I had some children that were getting involved in young men and young women.
So you had all four of your children by then?
Right. And I went back to, well, we went back to South Carolina, and I was called to in the High Council, and then I was called to be the stake mission leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I faced some of the same spiritual, intellectual, philosophical problems, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Were you trying to be a, I don't know what they call them, New Order Mormon or liberal Mormon, and just be invested in the culture and not so much the truth claims?
I tried it a bit, yes.
Oh, I think so.
Yes. But then my oldest daughter just started asking so many questions, and a lot of it was centered on her role in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And how upset she was becoming in young women, the things that they were telling her, like she had to be married.
The role that was being defined for her in her life.
The definition for her future role, yes.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think we ever put pressure on our children to be some defined role. I mean, within our house, we were never, I mean, in spite of the level of callings that we always had and the level of activity we maintained, we weren't, I think we blessed meals. That was about it. Occasionally, there were attempts at, okay, scripture studies or family home evenings, but that was generally not part of our family activity. We were more inclined to listen to music or play games or do something fun or more intellectually stimulating.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they had a lot of freedom to be who they were.
Okay.
And we encouraged a lot, especially around the dinner table. We had a lot of good discussions.
Right.
Yeah. So it was hard for us to see. I didn't like what my children were being told. I did not want them to be guilted for what I thought was normal behavior or normal thoughts or just closed in a very small box.
Mm-hmm. And they obviously felt they were in an environment where they could bring up those questions or problems.
I believe so.
Mostly.
And some things they might not have felt comfortable with.
Okay. So you, Michael, were dealing with all of this disbelief in the Mormon narrative, and you saw your daughter chafing under the teachings of the church. And when did all that start to come to a head? When did you start battling with, do I want to stay in the church and all that kind of stuff?
Well, this was between 97 and 99 when
okay.
we were in South Carolina. That's when I first found Eric's recovery from Mormonism.
RFM.
Different lists and blogs.
And so I started reading. I think the most important thing on the RFM was, for me at least, the biographies.
Mm-hmm.
Telling their stories and so on. That started. Then Richard Packham read some of his things. Bob McHugh came later.
Mm-hmm.
So we left South Carolina with major
issues.
Dissonance.
Yes.
And you went back to, or did you go to Denmark or Belgium?
Well, we went to Denmark via Washington, D.C., or Olney, it says, I think.
Yeah.
But that's Washington for some training.
Mm-hmm.
And
That was the end.
Okay.
Because of the kids, and I think for me, that's where it just accumulated to the point of no return. Mm-hmm. Just all the years of little things, and there was a young man in the ward that we went to there that would bear his testimony every single month, always. And it was the most heartbreaking thing in the world, because he would get up and say how hard he was trying, and he knew he had to change his ways, and he was sinning, but he was trying, and pretty soon he was going to be able to go on that mission. And it was just heartbreaking, because he was a wreck, and I thought, obviously gay. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a tragedy that he's making himself sick, you know, physically and emotionally, trying to be what his parents expect of him, what his church expects of him. And it was just heartbreaking, you know, that on top of the guilt and the lessons that our own children were hearing. And I just didn't want them to do it anymore.
You just wanted to get away from it.
Right.
So did you guys fade into an activity when you moved?
Well, when we moved from Maryland, yeah, we went to Copenhagen. I was working in the embassy there.
It was very easy to...
To a point, because unfortunately the ambassador was a Mormon. And he was in the bishopric.
Mm-hmm.
So I got there, and he knows I'm a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And right before we left, our oldest son went on a mission.
Oh, okay.
And that also put us in a spot where he wanted to go. We completely lied our way through interviews so that it would all go smoothly for
him. So you could go through the temple and all of that.
Right.
Yeah, but so this ambassador calls me up to his office and issues me a call.
At work.
He wants me to be the Sunday school superintendent for the Danish ward, which is okay because I was doing well enough with Danish at that time. But I said no. So I guess that was the end.
That was pretty gutsy too, because this wasn't just the bishop of the ward.
It was your boss.
It was your boss. Who could make anyone leave the country on a moment's notice.
Right. Did he handle that well?
I think he did. I didn't sense or feel any retribution.
Okay. And so you guys just were inactive, but you had a son on a mission.
We came to the conclusion we needed to tell him.
Mm-hmm.
So we got permission from the mission president in Rome, and visited him.
Oh, in person?
In person.
We did. I don't know why. We probably should discuss this with him someday about how he felt. But
he told us.
It had to be traumatic, but I couldn't bear it anymore because I wanted to be honest.
Right.
About it. And, so we went.
And did he... At the time, did he seem to react healthily, or was he pretty upset?
I think he was shocked. But it didn't seem to change the relationship that we already had.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
We did this at the very beginning of our visit, and we were able to stay there for a few more days, and so we had a nice, normal...
Right.
We took his district out for dinner.
We took the whole district out to dinner.
So.
But up until that point, I think he was probably struggling with his mission and the rules and the confinement of,
right.
I don't know. He's very intellectual, very well read. And I think he was finding this pretty mind-numbing.
Mm-hmm. The monotony of the mission.
Right. And rules that he thought was silly.
Right.
When he is so self-disciplined, I guess mm-hmm. he expected that everyone would be and they wouldn't need all those.
Mm-hmm.
But I think telling him, it seemed to eventually strengthen his testimony and trying harder.
I was talking to a guy whose family doesn't really... They don't really have respect for him now that he's left the church. And it seemed to me that his family looked at him as the poster child for what happens if you don't, like, hold to the iron rod. Do you think that maybe your son, and I don't think that your son disrespects you or anything, but do you think maybe he looked at your story and thought, well, this is what happens when you don't, you know, make sure your testimony is strong and pray all the time and read your scriptures all the time and hold to that rod?
Well, I don't know. We haven't had a negative life after that. I mean, it's always been...
No, but he may well have thought that at the time.
About your faith, anyway.
Oh, our faith, okay.
Right. And...
Yeah. We still get along quite well. I just visited, mm-hmm. saw our new granddaughter.
Good. Oh. And he's still a member, right? He's the only one of your children that's still a member.
Right.
Okay. So after you told you went to Rome and told your son about this, you're in Denmark or you're in Belgium?
We were in Denmark.
Denmark. So what happened after that, in that time period?
Well, we left Denmark and went to Belgium, working for the embassy.
Where we were kind of forced to take a stand because we were returning to the same place that we had mm-hmm. been, where Michael had been the bishop.
So people knew you.
So people knew us, and they knew we were coming. So we had to, yeah.
We submitted our letter.
That's when we did our resignation.
And did you talk to people about it before or after? What kind of reaction did you get?
Well, one of the bishop, whom we knew from before, talked to me and asked me why. We went over things, and I told him I didn't believe Joseph Smith was a prophet, and I told him why and all the things that I think he did that were, if not egregious, at least human.
Mm-hmm.
Went through the scriptures, Book of Mormon, Abraham, Bible, talked about racism. Just all those points that I thought added up to so much that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, well, I can take this little bit here is okay, but when you add all these things together, it just seems obvious to me.
The scales start to tip.
Right.
Okay.
And I don't think anyone said anything to me.
But we had a lot of friends that were there, and they didn't disown us.
No.
We came around.
Yeah, we still maintained friendships with some of the people that we had been friends with the first time there.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's a very different environment.
Right. So your oldest son was on a mission, so then the rest of your kids were teenagers, I'm assuming. Did you include them in the resignation? Did you say take all of our names off the records?
We did. Well, we asked the kids what they wanted to do.
Okay.
And yes, they all said, of course. And we're very happy to have their personalized letters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you guys are all over the world, right? Your children are in different countries. And I love your dog.
Okay, you talk, I'll go.
So have you guys maintained good family connections after all of this? No problems there?
Yeah, I think it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
while we're in Brussels, we could see our son in Sweden and our daughter in Scotland frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that we're in the States, we see our other son and our other daughter a little more frequently.
Right. How about your family the other direction? How did your dad react?
That was a problem. He knows. I didn't tell him directly. My sister did, though.
Uh-huh.
Before I had a chance.
Oh.
And he's good with it. He's the sweetest man.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's completely good with it, but he understands and hasn't treated me any differently.
It's not an issue for you guys. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
So did you guys go from Mormon to Christian, or are you guys devoid of any faith now?
No faith. No religious faith. How's that? Mm-hmm.
And that serves you guys well?
It does. Yes.
Good. Okay. So is there anything else that you guys wanted to talk about tonight? Anything that we skipped over?
Well, let's see. You also baptized my sister, so that's another guilt factor.
Oh, it's his dinner time. I'm sorry.
That's totally fine. So is your sister still a member? And how did she handle you guys resigning?
No reaction.
Okay. So I didn't cause tension there since she's still a believer?
No, we might harass her every once in a while.
I also think for her, the church is a sense of community and stability, where the majority of her friends, I don't think, are part of the church.
Okay.
Don't know how to put it. I feel like this has been a long time coming, should have come sooner.
Mm-hmm.
I think you also feel a loss of community. Because for you, it was much greater loss of community and culture. I could just return to normalcy. But
yeah, it's kind of you went off on this path for a little while and you're back to where you used to be, you know, before you joined the church. But for Michael, this is a complete change for him since he grew up in the church.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's enough years have passed that I should be getting used to it.
We're young at heart. That's why it took so long.
Well, so it sounds like you guys had a relatively painless exit and that you're pretty satisfied with where your life is now. Oh, what about skepticism? Michael, didn't you say something about how useful skepticism is?
Again, this is another dichotomy because I use skepticism all the time in my job. I mean, I'm in the Navy, you can't trust everything that you're told the first time, all the time. You have to check it. You have to look at situations. And so I wondered for a long time why I didn't apply that to my religious life.
Mm-hmm.
And then 12 years or so ago, started applying it a little more.
Understood. So do you think that the reason that the church battles against intellectualism and that kind of thing is because they know that if people start being skeptical or they start asking questions and they start using their intellects, that the church falls apart?
But more and more. But again, I see people, you know, we saw Joanna Brooks on The Daily Show this week.
Uh-huh.
After hearing her on, was it John Glenn's show?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she has very good points, but she drifted away from it, and now she's back to the church. And sometimes I wonder what her thoughts are. I would like to know that, because I think she puts her thoughts together very well, and she has a rational approach to things.
And so you wonder why she hasn't also continued into atheism rather than going back to the church?
Come to the same conclusions as I have, yes.
Right.
But that's true of so many people
we knew.
I mean, we've been very privileged in the locations that we've lived, that there has been a lot of extremely smart, well-educated people that were going along with it. I think it must be just community and culture that pulls a lot along.
Oh, we did.
Yeah. And even though we haven't had the family traumas and, you know, disowning of family members, it was still very traumatic to leave.
Well, yeah.
I mean, emotionally for us, it was, I think, quite a few years of real, real trauma.
But I think things that have helped. I like the Mormon Expressions is great, and the Voices, we think.
I like that one even better.
Thank you.
But I like, and I like the Mormon Stories too. But John DeLynn and John Larson have different approaches to their messages, and I like their philosophies. I probably identify more with John Larson.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the professional aspect that John DeLynn brings to his analysis.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's getting closer to a decision, maybe. I don't know.
So you think that this online podcast community kind of helps with what you might see as the loss of community afterward?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we did this in such a slow, long process that for decade or so, there wasn't any of that. I mean, it was either go to church or don't, and there wasn't a middle ground to bounce your ideas around or voice your concerns, and now that seems so easily accessible, and it's always nice knowing
mm-hmm.
I'm not the only one.
Right.
Don't beat yourself up too much. There's others that are wiser and smarter than you who have gone through the same process.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I was really excited when Michael reached out because of the fact that he'd been a bishop and in a stake presidency role, to see where dealing with people's problems and issues could have an impact on faith. So I imagine that's a pretty difficult job to have in the church. As always, if anybody wants to leave a comment or continue the conversation, you can come to the Mormon Expression website. It's www.mormonexpression.com/voices. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Letting go has not been easy, but I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was, not sure yet of who I will become.
Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C., and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations.
please consider a subscription today.